From the sports desk of the Lubbock Avalanche Journal and RedRaiders.com, here's your look at all things Texas Tech sports. Now, here's the Red Raider Podcast.
And hello, everyone. I'm Carlos Silva from the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, sports editor for the newspaper, bringing you the first edition of the Red Raider Podcast for the 2021 campaign. And, of course, wouldn't be a podcast without Don Williams, our longtime Texas Tech football beat writer. Donald, how are you doing, sir?
Doing great, Carlos. It's game week again. How about that?
Well, if anything, that just means you and I are busy again, you know, so that's always a good thing for both of us. And certainly it's a good thing for just overall everyone's kind of sanity, mental states, because I know last year was one for the ages. And hopefully that's the only time we have to kind of remember stuff like that with the once in a lifetime COVID-19 pandemic. But now hopefully things are a little bit better. I know there's still, talk of different things happening within the SEC, the Big 12. We'll get into that, obviously, either with some questions that we have. That's what this podcast will be focused on. But before that, we're going to talk a little bit about the Texas Tech game that's set for Saturday, I believe, at 6 p.m. NRG Stadium. We'll be covering that. Don't forget to go to LubbockOnline.com for the information on that game. And not only that, but then, of course, Tuesday's press conference that will have Matt Wells and some selected players as well. So we'll get all of that information. But to kind of get through things real quick, Don, before we get to the questions, because a lot of people actually did respond to your tweet, which isn't surprising because you're popular. I sent mine and I got like four or five and they were all dumb questions. Yours were actually good. But just from your perspective, looking at the depth charts for and Texas Tech, there were a couple of thoughts I had, but I was curious as to your takeaways from seeing the Texas Tech depth chart when it did pop up this morning.
Well, I was there were not a whole lot of surprises. There were really very few surprises. Yeah. We had kind of been projecting the depth chart on our position by position breakdown for the last week. Mm-hmm. But what we had was pretty close to what they released today. I guess the one thing maybe that's most notable to me was where they have Rico Jeffers listed. The surprise is not that they have him listed at as an either or starter.
Yeah,
John Merriweather. The surprise to me is where he was listed, because they have him listed at middle linebacker as mm-hmm. a co-starter with Krishan Merriweather. And the thing about that is they've reused Rico primarily as an edge guy, more really an outside guy for most of his career. So I was surprised to see him listed in the middle. Doesn't really surprise me that he's listed as like a co-starter or not automatically listed as a first team guy, because during the fall camp, during preseason camp, the guys we saw listed, or pardon me, the guys that we saw out there with the first team mm-hmm. were Carl Miller and Merriweather and Brandon Boyer Randall. Mm-hmm. And those are the guys who are listed first on the depth chart. So that wasn't a surprise. It was just a surprise to me where they have Rico listed in the middle now, which is a position that he had that seems like he has not played as much as he's played on the outside.
Yeah, I guess just from my perspective, I know this is something that I always focus on. And I know this was something that was kind of a back and forth thing between you and Coach Wells last year, but just the kicking situation. You look at place kicker Jonathan Garibay, it looks like he's going to get at least a start. Trey Wolf, of course, was battling him throughout preseason camp. But the other thing, I know this was something you kind of worked on for your positional breakdowns, but I thought it was interesting that Jackson Knott is a high school freshman and he's going to be your starting long snapper. I thought that was kind of interesting as well. But other than that, I thought everything.
Well, you know what? I was going to say real quickly, Carlos, you know, that's the thing that kind of flew under the radar this off season. And that is that Texas Tech starting deep snapper last year left the program, and that didn't get very much attention. And so all of Tech's deep snappers are guys who not only are going to be deep snapping for the first time this year for Texas Tech, they're all newcomers to the program. They're all mm-hmm. going to be up in scarlet and black jerseys for the first time this weekend. So, and I kind of as a rote, that's a position that nobody ever notices until something goes bad, until disaster happens. But that's worth keeping an eye on, because, again, these guys are all new.
Yeah. And then just the only other thing, if you had another thought before we get to questions, was thought it was interesting that Baron Morton was listed second as a holder behind Austin McNamara. I know, obviously, Austin – great holder, but kind of interesting if you're kind of thinking trick plays with Baron Morton, a very capable quarterback, to do something if he is holding for kicker Jonathan Garibay as well. But other than that, those are the only two things that stood out to me. Obviously, yours a little bit more, you know, kind of watching things as Rico was on the outside. Mine is just more, oh, there's a new long snapper. I mean, that was my biggest thing, and he's a freshman. So that was my biggest thing, just kind of take away.
One other thing I guess is kind of interesting to see is Sir Roderick Thompson is, in fact, listed as a first-teamer at running back. And we did as a starter because when he's healthy, he's gonna be the starter. But you know, he's a guy that had shoulder surgery this spring. And really from the time that happened, Matt Wells has said pretty much that he's questionable to be ready for the season opener. And so my guess is that we will either see Sir Roderick on a limited basis or not at all on Saturday night at Houston. And if he doesn't play at all Saturday night at Houston, that would not surprise me. That's not inside intel. That's just based on
common
fact,
sense.
You know, that's based on, let's see, the last time that Texas Tech had an open practice, I think was August 21st or August 23rd.
That week.
You know, basically a week or 10 days ago. And at that point, Sir Roderick had gone 4.5 months without contact. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of – I don't think you're going to see a situation where a guy goes 4.5 months without contact and then he practices for a couple or two or three days and then he's out there carrying 15 or 20 times Saturday night. So, again, I don't think he'll be big in the game plan on Saturday night if he plays – at all. And again, that's not any inside information. That's just my kind of how I.
Gotcha. Well, certainly some good information from you, Don. And of course, we're recording this on Monday. We're going to be talking to Matt Wells on Tuesday during his press conference. I'm sure those questions will be asked about Roderick Thompson and his status to see if he's going to be on a pitch count or if he's even going to be able to play. It could be a game time decision, which I'm sure will be a positive, a word that we hear a lot from coaches, but certainly, it's a good thing to see that Sir Roderick is at least being listed on the depth chart based on the shoulder surgery and the way that Matt Wells had mentioned the fact that they felt like he would be ready for the first game. It's just a matter of they just kind of had to see x-rays or MRIs and just to kind of see where he was. So on that note, let's switch to questions. And I know you had plenty of them, so we're going to start with you. I know one that really kind of probably made you laugh or maybe chuckle a little bit was from Ricky Morning. Is it too early to start asking Coach Leach to return?
Well, Ricky, that's not going to happen. I don't know if I think that's probably tongue in cheek, but
Mike, absolutely.
Mike is 60 years old right now, and I don't think there's any way that there's ever going to be a reunion between him and Texas Tech. I think the more interesting thing for Mike Leach and Texas Tech is at what point is Mike Leach honored by Texas Tech? Because I do think that will happen. I mean, he's your all-time he's your winningest coach. But I think we're still so close to the era of hard feelings that I think it could be – we could be still several more years from the time you see Mike Leach either as Texas Tech Hall of Fame or honored in any way. I think that to me is going to be the most kind of interesting development is when is Mike Leach back on the Tech campus? I think that I assume that'll happen at some point. Like I said, I think they'll honor him someday, but I don't think that day is close at hand.
Time heals all wounds, right? And maybe if there's a different administration, maybe things will change. Cause I know that's the one big thing that you and I have talked about is there are certain people that have certain feelings and maybe that's kind of what's kind of holding things up in terms of that. But I definitely agree with you. There's certain wins and certain, you know, factors that kind of do lead you to need to honor someone that has had that type of success in a school. But as of right now, it's going to be tough, especially when he's a current head coach at an SEC school. And we'll see how things go with him and obviously with his team in the SEC. But on that note, we'll switch to Dylan Vandergriff. He's got a question for you, Don. How do you think the offense will look under Sonny Cumbie, the new offensive coordinator after Yost, especially with Shuck, who's a veteran at this point?
Well, I think Tech fans are going to like it because I think Matt Wells said back in December when Sonny was hired that he is asking him to kind of revive the glory days of, you know, Texas Tech's offense, mm-hmm. and shoot the field, throw the ball down the field. And you have the quarterback to do that now with Tyler Shuck, because Tyler can make all the throws. He has a strong arm. He has arm talent. You know, his career numbers are not great. Don't knock your socks off. But, you know, and if there are analysts who project, who say if he has a good year this year, he could leave early for the NFL draft. At one point this offseason, there was one draft website that had him projected as the number one overall pick mm-hmm. next year. And so, and the reason why is because, again, he's 6'5", he's got the arm, and surprisingly for a guy 6'5", 220, he can really run. So a couple of thoughts. I think Sonny kind of is coming into a situation that maybe is a little bit similar to what he had at TCU, because he has a room full of, he has his top four running backs back with Thompson, White, Townsend, Brooks. And at TCU, they used for the last few years, or a lot of years, they tended to use a lot of running backs, use three or four guys. And so I think he again will use all these running backs. People, the component of how does Tech use its tight ends is going to be a question, with Travis Koontz being a returning starter. Mm-hmm. A lot of buzz in camp about Mason Tharp, mm-hmm. the freshman who's 6'9" and 255 pounds. I think you'll see the ball thrown to the tight end, but let's not get carried away. You look back to TCU. I was looking back at TCU's pass catching stats about the last couple of years, and they had Artavius Lynn and Pro Wells, and those are guys who caught about 12 to 20 passes apiece, 12, 15, 20 passes apiece. And I kind of think that's what you'll see from Koontz and from, I think, 20 catches for two, reasonable expectation for a true freshman. So I'm not going to get carried away with him. I think that the most interesting thing to me is going to be, okay, Sonny had Max Duggan, who could really run, of course. I mean, Max Duggan has sprinter speed at TCU.
Yep.
And Tyler Shuck can really run. Tyler Shuck is not Max Duggan, but I think Tyler Shuck is good enough that he can run, you know, he can run zone read and keep on designed run plays. And I'll be interested to see how much of that Sonny does.
I think it's also interesting to throw out this fact too, Don. I know you also have a guy in Henry Columbia that can do that as well if need be. Not to say that you're using two quarterbacks, but certainly that's an option, because I think that's one thing that people will be interested to see with this offense is there might be a little bit more motion than you're used to. You might see some different formations. I think that's something to kind of look forward to if you're a fan, because you were just so used to, well, here are the plays that we're going to run. We're going to run them the best. That's kind of what David Yost was known for. And unfortunately, I think you kind of look at what happened with the situation. It's just you didn't have a quarterback that probably ran what you wanted to. You didn't have maybe the skill position players that would help you be a little bit more successful. But here's the thing, is they were still averaging about 30-something points a game. It was just a matter of, I guess, just maybe some sort of philosophy, I guess, or maybe it's just something different. And I think that's certainly something that Matt Wells has been talking about. Like you said, just getting back to the Red Raider offense, what that is, we don't know yet, but I think for sure we're going to certainly see a lot more motion. We're going to probably see the running back start catching balls out of the backfield. I think you might see the tight end get some play as well. I mean, obviously they're going to be in there to block and help run block, but I certainly think that's something that you can do if you're able to split them out, get them on a linebacker. Like you had mentioned, Mason Tharp, Jed Castles, and another guy I've heard some buzz about is Henry Teeter as well during the offseason. I think if you get some of those guys, those are going to be some nice additions and some guys that could, you know, take advantage of that situation down the line. Anything else, switch off.
Yeah, and you're right about having a lot more motion, a lot more formations. It's going to be look night and day different from David Yost in that regard. I talked a little bit about the running backs, how they use the running backs, how they use the tight end. I was remiss in saying you have speed at receiver with Kalen Geiger on the outside, and you also have these outside guys who are 6'4", 6'4", 6'4", and 6'5", 6'3". I think they're going to They're going to try to throw the ball down the field, stretch the field. You know, Trey Cleveland, I think, is the kind of speed guy in that group. Yeah, got a lot of size guys. And I think this is a year where Eric Ezekanma can really come into his own and kind of take it to another level. He just looks better and better.
I think this question leads into what you were talking about and I was kind of mentioning. I apologize if I'm saying your name wrong. Chaz Poe, I believe, is what it is. But outside of quarterback, what is the one player on offense and defense that Tech cannot lose this season if they want to have a chance? I'm assuming it winning or, you know, having a good season is my guess.
You know, the thing about that is I think Tech's depth is to the point where I'm not sure there's a lot of, oh, you can't afford to lose this guy because there's nobody behind him, especially on defense. On offense, I think there's two players. You can't afford to lose TJ Stormen because your offensive line is pretty thin. I think your first five will be solid. Yeah. And then Landon Peterson is your top backup guard and Ethan Card is your top backup tackle. But if you lose one of the starters on the offensive line, that's probably critical. I said Stormen. Actually, you know, Dawson Deaton is the guy you can't afford to lose.
Center.
Who else do you have who's played center for this team last few years? Really nobody. So yeah. I'm kind of on offense between can't afford to lose Dawson Deaton and the guy. I think if you lose Eric Ezekanma, for all the talk about what you have at receiver, Eric is still the guy. And if he were to go down, you don't have anybody else necessarily who you know for sure is a go-to guy in the Big 12.
Mm-hmm.
Defensively, for me, it's a harder one who you can't lose because, again, he got about four or five corners who have played. You have some experience at safety. I'll tell you, maybe a guy who – You have a half a dozen linebackers. All of your top linebackers that played last year are back. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be great to lose any of them, but I think you could manage if one were lost to you for a month. I think I would say the guy that you can't afford to lose might be a guy that – well, one of Jalen Hutchings or Tony Bradford, I'd say, is the guy that you can't afford to lose on defense.
Well, certainly going to agree with you on that. I think everything else is shored up in terms of what they were able to do with the transfer portal, that being the defensive backs, the safeties, cornerbacks, linebackers, all that stuff. I think the one question, if there is a question on defense, is can the defensive line get pressure? Can the defensive line work? Because now you've got Tyree Wilson, who's not 3 days in, and he kind of has to play. Now he's got, you know, an offseason to work. You got Nelson Embanasor, who unfortunately, I believe he's, we'll see what happens with him. And then, like I said, Devin Drew, Philip Bleedy, heard a lot about Philip Bleedy. He's a second as a tackle, so we'll see how he's working. But I certainly think if Jalen Hutchings or Tony Bradford are not there, that middle interior is going to be really, really important for Texas Tech in terms of what they want to do with all the linebackers that they have, because certainly all those linebackers can make plays, much less in space. But you can't make those plays if your guys – up front aren't filling up the zones or, you know, taking some of those blocks away from those guys. So I think I agree with you on that. In terms of quarterback, offense, I think one player that people aren't talking about, Don, in terms of that you really need, and I agree with you, Dawson Deaton. He's a guy that is versatile. He switched to center because he's been there. And it's something that I don't know if anyone's really asked. I know Clayton Franks is listed as the backup center, but I'm kind of interested to see as to what kind of led them to get Clayton Franks there. Because if I'm not mistaken, I think he was a guard when he first got here. That could be.
Well, he's worked at center. I think the question, if he's a guy that if he went down, or pardon me, if Deaton went down, would you put in the players listed as the second team center? Or would you move guys around? I think actually what would happen if Dawson Deaton went down, I think Weston Wright would be your center, and then Landon Peterson would go in at guard.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's switch it to Colt at Reckham Colt. What's the ceiling for Tech this year in terms of national offensive and defensive rankings?
You know, if all your receive, you know, if your receivers click and Shuck, if Shuck reaches his potential, then I think your ceiling on offense is, you know, you should be a, you'd be a top 20, top 25 offense. I think that's very realistic to think is conceivable. What is Tech's ceiling? What should Tech be defensively if it all comes together? They were 99 last year, number 99 last year in total defense. I would say, you know, top 75 and maybe higher than that, because I was looking at the NCAA rankings in total defense last year, and you had six Big 12 teams that were in the top 50, which, you know, the Big 12's offensively has not been as good recently as it has traditionally. And so you had, again, six Big 12 teams last year in the top 50. Mm-hmm. Texas seventh was number 64 in total defense. So I think it's very realistic to say Tech should be a top 75 defense. And I don't think it's out of the question when you talk about ceiling for them to crack the top 50 in total defense. And if they did that, it would be one of your best defenses that you've had in the last 20 years. And so much of that, again, depends on guys that we really haven't seen yet being kind of living up to the credentials. Because, you know, a lot of these transfer guys are guys who are not just backups elsewhere. There are guys who started elsewhere. You know, Marquise Waters, he was Duke's second or third leading tackler each of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Fred Pearson was the fourth leading tackler on the team. It was on the Wisconsin team that was won 10 games and went to the Rose Bowl.
Yep.
So there are guys who are coming in with some credentials and could actually give you a really big boost in those rankings.
Last one from Twitter before we switch to some emails. Aaron Baxter, friend of the show and takes really good photos at Lubbock Cooper. Who are the players, old and new, that no one is talking about that could have a big impact?
Let's see. Old. I'll tell you, the guys who you tend to, a lot of times, guys get overlooked who, if they don't come in and do great things right away, people kind of maybe forget about them or assume that, okay, they're sort of ordinary and they're never going to be that good. But that's kind of an unfair analysis in a lot of situations, because a lot of guys take time to develop and, you know, kind of get their feet on the ground and get adjusted to college football and then benefit, you know, after a couple of years in the weight room. And then kind of, you know, turn it on when they're juniors and seniors. I think a couple of guys maybe who maybe fit that category, Plain Mannix, I think, could be set up to have a big senior year. He's dealt with a lot of injuries in the time that he's been here. In the time that he's been here, he arrived with quite a bit of fanfare, because when he came from Nevada, he had a couple of seasons where he caught 50 passes when he was a freshman sophomore. And then it immediately translated, and he got hurt, and then he got hurt again. And people have kind of figured, and people have kind of written him off. But now you look at him, he's, you know, he's there at the top of the depth chart at inside receiver. And I think with him being healthy, finally getting an extended stretch where he's felt okay, I think he could really have a good senior year. And I think another, a younger guy who kind of is in that category, I'd say, is Trey Cleveland.
Yep.
His third year in the program. He's played a little bit, not a lot, but he's a guy on the outside who's tall. He's probably, I think, the fastest of those outside receivers. If not him, it's Kalen Geiger, but then Trey Cleveland is a guy who's really good on the vertical ball. So I think he's a guy who could break out this year as far as guys who have been here.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on the inside receivers in terms of McLean Mannix. So one guy I would add is Loic Fungi. I think he's going to be a guy that could be a huge red zone threat. I think that's going to be someone that could get touchdowns. He may not get the yards that maybe a Geiger or, you know, a Mannix or a Cleveland may be getting, but I think he's certainly going to be a red zone threat with his, like you had mentioned, Don, the sides that you have out there. You got a 6'5" and Jaron Brandley, 6'4" and Loic Fungi. Eric Izukanma, 6'3". And then, of course, you go to Geiger. He's more of the speed guy at 5'5", 5'10", but then you got Trey Cleveland, 6'4", J.D. Sparkman, 6'4". And I think that's something that Texas Tech is going to certainly utilize when they do get in the red zone. And I think Love Fungi is going to be the guy. In terms of anyone else,
I was going to say,
think of anyone. Go ahead.
Well, Aaron also asked, he said old players and new. So yes. I'll give you one. It's hard to think of the new players making a big impact that nobody's talked about, because I feel like we've talked about all these new guys so much.
Mm-hmm. So
I really feel like there's many under the radar new guys, but I think one under the radar new guy who will have an impact, I don't know if it'll be this year, but a new guy who is going to have an impact at some point is Josiah Pierre, the linebacker who transferred to Florida. He's a sophomore, and he's a guy who played I believe he played in 13 games as backup at Florida. It's another guy.
3 years left. 3 years left for those.
Yeah, has 3 years left, or four. I forget which. But anyhow, he's a guy that played a little bit at Florida, didn't put up big stats, but was a state top 100 recruit in Florida. And I thought one of the things that caught my ear the most that I heard the entire month of August. One of the things that caught my ear the most was when Keith Patterson said, Josiah Pierre might be the most explosive linebacker that Texas Tech has, and that's saying something. That's what that's what Keith Patterson said. Mm-hmm. Might be the most explosive linebacker we have, and that's saying something. And yes, that's saying something when you're saying he's more explosive than Colin Schooler, who leveled Charlie Brewer last year. And John Merriweather, who unloads on people, and Rico Jeffers. And,
I mean, he's also coached some guy named Jordan Brooks, too, that's playing for Seattle.
Well, he didn't say all time. He said on this team.
Oh, gotcha.
He said most explosive linebacker on this, he was suggesting on this team.
Gotcha.
But again, that's saying something when you're talking about, five-year top eight returning tacklers or guys are in that linebacker room. And Keith Patterson said Josiah Pierre might be the most explosive guy of all of them. And, he's as he gets older and you see more of him, I think he's a player that fans are going to like, because he has a real outgoing personality, very talkative, not in like a bragging or trash talking way. He's just kind of a naturally, seems just like
engaging.
Engaging. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Pretty good. Engaging personality, and it sounds like he's going to be the real deal.
Yeah, and then just to kind of go outside the box, I mentioned it already, but I think Jackson Knotts could be someone that is absolutely new. He's a freshman out of high school. He's going to be a long snapper for Texas Tech, and certainly people will know his name if things go awry, but at least from what it seems like, I think the focus is going to be on if Jonathan Garibay or Trey Wolf can be consistent. Garibay obviously going to get the starting nod going into Houston. We'll see if he's able to do it. I think that's going to be an interesting thing, is to see the way things are called, or the way that Matt Wells feels after that first kick, whether it's a miss or a make, because I know that was certainly something last year that was really tough, is when you're getting into that 35 yard, you would think you get 3 points out of it, and you almost kind of wonder if Matt Wells is going to go for it on fourth down inside that. And I think that's certainly something that could be something that happens this fall, but certainly we can look at it. And I don't know how you feel about it, Dom, but I think right now, at least for right now, that first one's going to be the most important kick that Jonathan Garibay makes, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, sorry. For those that don't know, we're doing this on Zoom on some questionable Wi-Fis on both of our houses. So if we're going in and out, we apologize. It hasn't been too bad so far, but just, so essentially, like I said, long snapper Jackson Knotts, that's going to be mine. Going to a question from the emails as we kind of wind down on this. I don't see a countdown on the Zoom right now, Don, so I think we're still good on time in terms of what we're doing. But from a longtime listener, Taylor Hampton, what is a realistic timeline on conference realignment? I know it's a little bit of a shift, so that's why I'm kind of talking a little bit, so you can get your mind a little ready. I know you've reported on it, spoken to Kirby Hokut a couple, as the Big 12 looks to potentially expand, or at least look at some of those options, with Kirby Hokut being on a board of directors or some sort of, committee. Also, do you?
He's on the subcommittee for.
Thank you, subcommittee.
Subcommittee, but clarify that by saying all the conference presidents and all the ADs are involved in this. Kirby's just one of four. Kirby's just one of four, two ADs, a president and a chancellor who were kind of charged with kind of leading that effort and getting the ball rolling. But let's see, the question was timeline.
So essentially, let me see here. Going back to the question, because like I said, I was trying to talk so you could get back into that mode of conference realignment. But what is a realistic timeline on conference realignment? The second part of that question. Also, do you think this is it, or will we be going through another realignment in 5 to 7 years when the next TV deal is up? So I'm assuming they're talking about the Big 12 deal or maybe another deal in another conference whenever those do run out.
Yeah. So as far as a timeline, anywhere from 6 months to 4 years.
Yeah.
And nobody knows. That's the thing. And anybody who says they know is just guessing. I think you might have some clarity by the end of the calendar year. I don't think you're going to have clarity in the next month. I think it's going to be something that we're going to be talking about throughout the season. And when I say you might have some clarity by the end of the calendar year, I think that means you might know where one or two dominoes fall. But I think this is going to be a protracted thing. It's going to take time. I think, you know, the biggest question to be resolved first is simply when did Texas and Oklahoma leave?
Yes.
Because, you know, we've written about this all the way back to, I went back and looked last night, July 24th. We talked about, okay, Texas and Oklahoma, if they leave, they owe 2 years worth of conference distributions to the conference. That's about $40 million a piece times 2 years. That's about $150 to $160 million. Some people have just discovered this in the last few days. We've been writing about this for a month.
I'll give you some props, Don. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to give you your props. You kind of almost broke this story in a way because you mentioned when you spoke to Lawrence Kubinick, the Texas Tech president, and he had told you, probably in passing, honestly, that they didn't agree to some TV deal. Or I can't remember the exact story. You can obviously correct me, but essentially you spoke to Lawrence Kubinick for just a story. And it turns out like, oh, all of a sudden when you realize ESPN doesn't want to talk to the Big 12 about, you know, renewing contracts, all of a sudden all this stuff pops up. And I think that was one of the triggers almost, if you want to look at it.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a trigger, but it certainly, when they said that the Big 12 was approached ESPN and Fox about renewing Big 12 contract early, they said no. That got some attention nationally. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Bob Bowlsby, as it turns out, was happy with Lawrence Kubinick for making that public. But what I was going to say, though, is, you know, we've been writing since July that how much Texas and Oklahoma owe when they leave.
Yes.
$160 million, but they also owe, you know, their revenue from their home games.
Which is interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Their SEC home games, if they leave before 2025, like if Texas hosts Alabama or if Oklahoma hosts LSU, that revenue still goes to the Big 12.
And that was what I was going to say.
We first wrote about that on July 24th. And again, in mid-August, some people have just started coming around to talking, have just discovered that, I think.
Yeah. And that was
But here's the thing, though. Here's the thing, though. If they don't, you know, it's possible that they could be here for longer than this year. It's possible that they could be here for, you know, another couple of years. You know, if it plays out that way, then again, we could be still talking about this till 2024, 2025. And is there going to be a realignment beyond this one? Yes. And here's why. Conference realignments have gone on for, I'm 56 years old. Conference realignments have been going on my entire lifetime. When I was a kid, what is now the Pac-12 was the Pac-8. And then Arizona State came in and Arizona came in and it was the Pac-10. And then it became the Pac-12. And, you know, Arkansas in 1990, Arkansas left. 1991, 1992, Arkansas left for the SEC. And then in 2000, around the 2010, 2012, we had more realignment when, you know, Big 12, or pardon me, 1996, Big 12 formed. And those teams gradually left from about 2010 through 2012.
From the old Southwest Conference.
Yeah, so I think there's going to be, whenever this next round of realignment is done, there'll be a round of realignment beyond that.
Yeah. So in other words, as your column said, just stay patient. You're going to be anxious. Just get used to that feeling, essentially. So I think that's the biggest thing to take away. But other than that, I think I got most of the important questions going on, at least from your Twitter, from my Twitter. Now there's a couple silly ones that we can kind of get through.
Let's go back. We
go ahead. Oh, did you?
Okay. Tolliver, yeah, Tolliver Brothers asked.
I missed that one. You are.
Pardon?
I did miss that one. That's my fault. I meant to get it.
Yeah, well, the state legislature let the two largest land-grant universities bolt to the SEC with Texas oil money. Texas half an importer, 32 state rest.
Yes.
Well, was the state legislature let the largest universities go? Yes, and here's why. They don't have the power to stop them.
Yeah.
This is a different time and it's a different landscape than it was when the Southwest Conference broke up, mm-hmm. and when the Big 12 formed, and when Bob Bullock was able to tell people that you're going to take Texas Tech and Baylor.
Great column, by the way, for those that haven't read it, by Don Williams on Bob Bullock. So,
yeah, those days are gone, and there's nothing that the legislature's going to do to stand in the way. I hesitate to denigrate their efforts, but that this is something that they should have. If they were going to put legislation in place to keep this kind of thing from happening, it would have been good to initiate it 6 or 7 years ago, not after the two schools have already announced that they're leaving.
Well, essentially what I can't remember if you were watching this with me, but whenever the Texas president was on, I guess, blast, if you will, in front of a few people, I think that was just essentially a roast of the University of Texas, because like you said, Don, they can't really do anything. I think the one thing, not to get too political, because obviously you and I are not political science majors, but I think you're going to hear a lot about the PUF fund, the Permanent University Fund, and how that could potentially help Texas Tech in terms of maybe helping them if they decided to go to another conference and maybe giving them a little bit of money, kind of a la what the University of Texas has been getting from the PUF fund. And I think that's really the biggest domino that will fall will be is how will Texas Tech be able to maybe work out something to where they can either, maybe they're not getting a full share going into a new conference, but this PUF fund helps a little bit, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think you have to have what? Amend the state constitution to do that.
So people again, are not a political science.
Again, this is something. this is something that you're not going to change in a week or a month.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah, but yeah. So it's just a big mess.
Let's see. Texas Tech Sean has asked. Says I'm 33 years old. What do you think? That's about what you are, Carlos, right?
About 2 years younger.
You might. You might not even be 33.
Yeah.
Sean says, is Tech going to win a conference in my lifetime? And I would say yes.
Yeah.
Because, Sean, I think you got about another 60. I think you're good for another 50 years, maybe 60.
Making him 93. That's pretty good. It's a pretty good life.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're saying, will Tech win a conference title in the next 50 or 60 years, I'd yes or no. You have to bet your money one way or the other, I'd say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a positive look, not only for Texas Tech getting a conference title, but thinking that this guy is going to live 60 years. So I think that's a positive both ways there, Don.
Okay. I mean, I said, well, I'll say 50. We'll give Sean, I think Sean's good for 50. He should make it to 83. And I think you'll be celebrating the Texas Tech Conference Championship at some point between now and then.
I would hope so. And the thing is like there may be some medical breakthroughs. Maybe he lives a little bit longer. So you never know. I mean, either way, but 50 to 60 years, I think, is enough time to, you would think in some time during that, you can find a way to get yourself a conference title at some point, you would think. But, you know, who knows? But certainly a good question.
Let's see. About, let's see. Right, we can go back. We can ask. We can look at some of the questions that some of our buddies are asking us tonight. Ryan King of Ryan King Now says.
Ryan King Now, not a buddy.
Not a buddy. Tech opens at a neutral location, Ryan says. Will there be more Tech fans than Houston fans? And bonus, Ryan wants each of us to predict the attendance with the winner being closest. I'll let you go since I read that question.
Okay. Well, if I'm not mistaken, I believe NRG holds about 72,000, give or take, I believe. I mean, that's just a guess, but I'm going to say there are going to be more Tech fans just based on the Houston Texas Tech base. At least from what I've heard, there's a big base there. There's a big base in DFW. I mean, we've heard it all. San Antonio. I'm going to say people are going to be very fired up to go and just watch football, frankly, Don. I mean, I think it's been a tough year, as we kind of alluded to at the start of this podcast. I think people want to get out and enjoy themselves. They're going to certainly be able to do that. And I think Tech fans are going to enjoy themselves. I'm going to say it's going to be, I'm going to say 56,500.
Wow, 56.
I'm going to go 56.
Well, I'm going to say about 47.
Okay. Now, again,
Here's the thing, though. How many of that 47,000? It's clearly got to think going to be more Texas Tech fans than Houston fans, just because Texas base is so much bigger than Houston.
Yeah.
I think, see, you know, 30,000 Tech fans and 17,000 Houston fans.
Yeah, like I said, I honestly think there's going to be, with my guess of the 55,500 or 50, I can't remember what I said, 56,500, I think. I think there's just going to be the casual fan that just wants to go out and, you know, watch said game. But I certainly think that there's going to be more Tech fans. Now, I don't think he asked the specific question as to how many, but, you know, I just think there's going to be more Tech fans. And he asked for an attendance, 56,500. So that's where I'm at.
One more here. Stephen Reyes says, is it bowl or bust this year for Matt Wells to be coaching next year here at Texas Tech?
I feel like we've been asked this the last couple of years, but I think the answer is yes. I mean, if you want to elaborate, you can, Don, but I think for me, you've got all these transfers, all this experience. It's going to be kind of tough to, you know, explain, well, we weren't able to do much this year because we had one of our deepest, one of our most experienced rosters. We finally have the quarterback that we've been looking for. We have a good running game. The defense has had the same defensive coordinator the last 3 years, so there's continuity there. I feel like it's going to be really tough to, you know, bring back a coach if you don't have at least 6 to 7, heck, even 8 wins this year, just based on, you know, just all the positives that have been happening, or at least in my view, the positives that are showing after the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. As much as even though from the outside perspective, you know, Tech is picked 9th in the conference, and a lot of the, you know, national publications and whatnot are forecasting another down year for Tech. Mm-hmm. They seem to be getting a little more traction here lately, but for the most part during the summer, most people seem to think that Tech was still going to be at or near the bottom of the Big 12. Don't look for anything from the Red Raiders. But again, I think for all the reasons that you just listed there, I think it's going to be hard to justify this team not winning at least 6 games this year. Now, as to the question of do you keep Matt Wells after that, if you were to go 5-7, again, I think it would be hard to justify why this team should not have won more. The only thing I think which stands in the way of that is, again, you run into a coach who has 4 years left on his contract as we speak, 3 years left at the end of this season. You would owe him, you'd have to buy him out. I think you'd be talking, and I haven't looked at it lately, I believe you'd be looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 million or so, maybe. I might be wrong on that, but, you know, several million, and that's at a point when your budget is about $20 million or more less now than it was pre-COVID. And so then you would have to justify, okay, you're spending when you have already lost 25 or so million from your regular budget. And now you have the uncertain future based on realignment where you could be losing even more. So from a financial standpoint, couldn't you afford to fire coach if you were facing that decision this year. That would be the one thing that might stand in the way of it. But again, I think what you said is correct. I think this is a team that has the personnel to win 6, 7, 8 games and needs to win 6, 7, 8 games to show progress.
Yeah. Well, since we're going into some of these silly questions, since we obviously talked to Ryan King and allowed him on our airwaves, the Rocky Creek game, friends of ours, I've been on their show, great people, Sean Dillon and all them. He's asking, worst travel nightmare covering Texas Tech sports? I think I know this answer because we've discussed this, because I remember talking to you about being on essentially a prop plane when I went from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Huntington, West Virginia. And that's probably something, I mean, the girlfriend got me to do it, and it's great to say that I did it. But man, you talk about turbulence, Don. When you're in a small little plane and that turbulence hits you, it's not fun. So that was probably, if I had to guess just off the top of my head, that was certainly an experience.
For you me. Said that was,
go ahead.
You said that was what? You said that was Huntington to where?
That was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Huntington, West Virginia, because the girlfriend said, hey, it's about as much as it would be if you rented a car, because typically we rent cars to go from kind of pulling back the curtain here on how we travel. But typically we would drive from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Huntington, West Virginia to cover said game, whether that's football or basketball. And she's like, well, it's a 45-minute drive or a 45-minute flight compared to the hour and a half drive that you would normally take. And I'm like, hey, you know what? It's not too bad. And of course, you know me, Don, I don't look or pay attention to things like that. So I didn't realize it was like essentially the plane that you see from the Indiana Jones films. So it was a pretty small plane. And like I said, the turbulence hit it, and it wasn't very fun for me, but it was pretty cool to see some, you know, I got to see Heinz Field from kind of a nice little deal, PNC Park as well. But other than that, that was probably the highlight of said crazy flight for me.
Yeah, I had, we've been on hundreds of flights. I've been on hundreds of flights because of this business.
Yes.
One stands out by far as the worst. It was after the 1991 Texas Tech at Baylor football game. That's a game that's remembered for it was raining all day in Waco, and Donnie Brooks returned a fumble 99 yards for a touchdown, and Tech beat Baylor. And that night, I got on a plane at Waco to fly to, I don't remember if it's DFW or Love. And in this day and age, we might say we took a plane from Waco to Dallas.
Yeah.
Now we drive everywhere. That's within 8 hours. But yeah, we took a plane to go to Dallas. It was a one-seater on each side for 8 months, I think. There were literally like 15 people on the plane.
Yeah, that's about mine.
And the storm continued that night, and it was terrible. And I that was the most – and I'm not a nervous flyer, and that was the – that was a night that I thought we were going down, and so I could have been out of here at age 26. I was afraid I was going to be. And here's the interesting thing, is that you know, Robert Giovanetti was on that same plane with me, and it was a few years back we were talking about bad flights. We were having this conversation.
Yep.
And Gio happens to be standing in the same circle of people. And Gio goes, hey, were you on the flight from Waco to Dallas? And I said, yes, I was on that flight. He didn't even have to finish the sentence. That's how bad the flight was. Yeah. We both knew what we were talking about. Gio and I could have been, both of us, gone that night in November 1991. That was the worst. Now, I got one kind of humorous bad travel experience.
Okay.
When Tech played at work. 1992, and I did not book a hotel in advance. I guess for some reason I thought I'll just get a hotel when I get up there. Yeah. And I understand now. Of course, okay, that sounds crazy. Yeah, that sounds crazy. But this was 30 years ago. Okay,
I'm not when we use phones, rotary phones, people. You know.
Yeah, and this is 30 years ago, and attendance at college football was not at a level that it is now. College football is popular, but look at the 1990s, and college football is not as popular. You know, it was popular, but it was not as attended back then. So getting a hotel is, you know, I'll get a hotel when I get there. No big deal.
And also not only that, but then just to kind of throw on that, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have all these, you know, random sites where you can just kind of book a hotel like that, you know?
Yeah. And now Oregon is, a marquee program in college football back then.
Yeah.
Oregon had the longest losing streak in college football. And I think the attendance at Alston Stadium that day, I want to say it was 28,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the reason why hotels was not because of the football game. The reason was because they had this civic event that weekend that was called Eugene Days, mm-hmm. which is a big annual celebration, come to find out. So all these people came in from across Oregon or wherever for Eugene Days. It was not because of the football game, because the Ducks were bad. It was because of Eugene Days. You couldn't get a hotel. And so spent about 2 hours after that game getting a hotel and wound up sharing a room with Eddie Clinton, who was former Lubbock sportscaster. Eddie is best known these days because he was on that crazy call of the Plano East Tyler John Tyler game, playoff game where they had a huge comeback, and they said, "I want to puke." Eddie, those guys. Eddie and I, neither one of us had a hotel room. We wound up finally getting a hotel about 2 hours after that game.
That's incredible because I do love that video. That's kind of crazy that you have actually met that guy. That's incredible.
Yeah, he used to work at KCBD in Lubbock many moons ago.
Gotcha. Well, kind of sticking with the old funny. Speaking of, I guess, travel, I guess we can switch to, let me see here. There was another one that someone asked me. Where's it? I assume this is a friend of the show. You can confirm or deny this, Donald. David Collier on TV. Red Raider Nation.
We'll grant David Collier friend of the show status.
All right, friend of the show, David Collier. Where does Don eat when he goes to Houston?
You know, I can't really think of. I don't really have a go-to place in Houston.
Interesting. Frenchie's Chicken, my man. It's the best.
Okay.
Chicken.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's for those that don't know, my goal is to always take Don to fun places when we do travel. So at the Big 12, you got to try Babe's Chicken in DFW, and you were very pleased with it. So I was happy with that.
I think to answer Collier's question, I think, I've been to Papacito's, I guess, three or four times.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Papacito's is good.
It's not my favorite, not to diminish them, but I think that's been a place where I've eaten several times, a few times. Gotcha.
Speaking of food, Keith Patrick, friendship man, friend of the show, works for a Red Raider dugout and obviously good friend of both of ours. Has Don ever tried sushi? I'm assuming the answer is no.
The answer is no.
Follow-up, why not?
I generally eat from about three food groups. That is barbecue, Tex-Mex, and home-style. We're close to any of those, so the answer is no. And I'll just have to pass on from this world to the next world, never having known how good sushi is.
Yeah, or raw fish, I suppose, is the other things people don't. Last one, at least from the silly questions on my part before we kind of wrap this up, because I'm kind of shocked we're not getting told by Zoom that this is too long. But Collier had a follow-up word to your where does Don eat when he goes to Houston. The next question he had was French toast, waffles, or pancakes. I'm a pancake guy through and through. But you can put whatever you want on pancakes, especially butter and syrup. They're awesome. But that's just me.
I'm pretty much pancakes or – I'm okay with pancakes or waffles, either one.
Yeah.
I don't have a strong preference in that group.
For me, you can get really good pancakes. Obviously, Pancake House here in Lubbock, big fan of them. Austin as well has a very good place that you and I always frequent every once in a while when we get there. And for some reason, the name escapes me at this moment, and it's going to kill me. But, oh, my God, I can't think of it right now, and that's really annoying. But, yeah, it's usually open late.
I know where you're saying enough too.
I'm sure I'll be told on Twitter or something, but Kirby Lane is what I was thinking of. But yeah, so those are the two places I like. Love pancakes, huge team breakfast fan. That's my answer. Anything else from you, Don, or any other final thoughts for you? Because like I said, we'll probably do another one of these. It'll either be with you to kind of go through some of the Tuesday press conference stuff. And then the second portion will probably be with my buddy Joseph Duarte. We'll probably do that. And he can give us all the info that he knows about the Houston Cougars as he covers them as well for the Houston Chronicle.
Yeah, I think they'll probably take care of us for now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. So a good thing, obviously, for the content, but probably a tough thing for the editor that has to do this. But again, that's Don Williams, longtime beat writer for the Texas Tech football team. You can follow him at @AJ_DonWilliams for all the Texas Tech information you need. And then, of course, as we get into game day, don't forget to go to LubbockOnline.com. If you're here in Lubbock, don't forget to pick up the newspaper or, of course, get a digital subscription. And then, of course, you can follow me at @CMSilvaJR. I'll be in Houston covering that game. Don, of course, will help us with that coverage as well. And, of course, that game will be at 6 p.m. on Saturday at NRG Stadium, home of the Houston Texans. We appreciate y'all listening to another edition of the Red Raider Podcast. We will talk to you soon.